I'm Vernon Trollinger for Optometry Times, and this is 10 questions for Lyndon Jones, OD, Director of the Center for Ocular Research and Education at the University of Waterloo in Ontario, Canada.
Where did you grow up?
So I was born in a little place in South Wales, a place called Cwmbran, that I doubt anyone would ever be able to spell because it's C-W-M-B-R-A-N. I grew up there, went to university, pretty close to there, actually only about 12 miles away at the University of Cardiff, and then moved to London after that.
What did your parents do?
So my dad worked in a factory and mum worked at home. The area that came from in South Wales was a relatively poor area. No one else in my family has been to university, so it was pretty unusual when I went to university, for sure.
How did you get involved in contact lens research?
Good question. Probably an easier thing to do, actually, is more, you know, how do I get involved in optometry generally? So when I was in school, I didn't really know what I was going to do. So I actually took a year off. And in my year off, I actually worked as a DJ. So I was DJing right through sort of my later years of school. Really enjoyed that. So in my year off, I DJed at night and actually drove a truck delivering sports goods during the day. Decided after a couple of years that I probably wasn't ever going to make enough money being a DJ, so decided to go to university. And actually, the reason that I ended up going to Cardiff University was twofold. First of all, because it was the one closest to home, so it meant that I could continue to be a DJ working on the weekends. So I ended up working the same clubs that I'd been working at when I was at school. So that's how I chose the university, and I purely chose optometry because they actually had the best intramural rugby team. and that's exactly how I chose optometry. I looked at the university, went, okay, who's got the best rugby team? It happened to be optometry. That's what I put my name down for. I knew nothing about optometry whatsoever. So I went to university, did optometry, found that I absolutely loved it. Optometry is slightly different in the UK in that it's still a four-year course, but in your fourth year, you don't stay at the university as you would in North America. You actually go either into private practice or work at a hospital or a teaching institution. I ended up doing my fourth year in a teaching institution in London. And then when you've done that one year, you then take your professional exams. So when I took my professional exams, had to make a decision about what I was going to do. I actually happened to be a pretty decent teacher. So the teaching institution I was at actually offered me a job. So I ended up working part-time in that same place that I did my final year's training at. Part-time there and then part-time in university. As part of my job at that teaching institution, we often did clinical trials with contact lens companies, and that's how I started to get involved in contact lens research.
Now, you were a director at a practice in London for 11 years. Oh, how did you come to the University of Waterloo, and why choose to stay in Canada?
I started working in that practice when I graduated, which was 1986, started working there part-time. By 1990, I was given the opportunity to buy into the practice. It was a very long established practice. The practice had been around, actually, there was two sites. One had been around for almost 100 years. It had been fitting contact lenses since the 60s, so it had a very long history of fitting contact lenses. So I thought, you know what, this is an opportunity to get into a very long established practice. My wife, Debbie, who's an optometrist also, she's also on faculty at University of Waterloo, was looking for something different to do as well. So she joined us in that practice. And so the two of us as optometrists, in partnership with one of the sons, actually, of the two guys who owned the two practices that we bought into, was a dispensing optician. We bought out the practices in 1991, grew them quite successfully. They won several awards in the UK. We were Contact Lens Practice of the Year for 3 years, overall Practice of the Year for a year, Marketing Practice of the Year for a couple of years. So that they were really nice big practices. But by about sort of mid to late 90s, I was just finishing doing my PhD, which I'd done part-time, and had to make a decision about whether I was either going to stay in private practice or move to academia. And the challenge to move to academia seemed like a good idea at the time, on the basis that we could always come back to practice. So Debbie and I kind of sent our CVs off around the world, and the first place that we managed to get two offers was Canada. So we came to Canada in 1998, decided, you know, as many of these things, you go, we'll be there for a couple of years and we'll come back. we're still there 20 years later. So this year is 20 years, almost to the date, actually, almost 20 years now, to the date that we moved to Canada. Our kids are now very Canadian. We're very settled here, so I don't see us going back, that's for sure.
So what keeps you there?
A couple of reasons. First, living in Canada is great. I think people who are Canadians who've not lived elsewhere probably don't appreciate how lucky they are to live in Canada. You know, the winters are tough. The winters suck. They're pretty cold. But it's very safe, very friendly, lots of open space, very clean air. It really is. It's a great place, great opportunity to bring up kids. So that I've enjoyed. But the main thing that keeps me here is CORE. So CORE, as its new name is, the Center for Contact Lens Research is what it's been for the last 29 years, is an amazing place. I mean, we have great people. We've done some great work over the years. That the founding director, Des Fon, really did set up something that's quite a unique institution. And so now with the great group that we have doing the clinical research plus the biological sciences group, it's pretty hard to find anything to compete with it, to be honest. So that's why we're still here.
What got you interested in ocular pharmaceuticals and drug delivery?
Ah, good question. Good question. So in the years that I've been here, so I've been here 20 years, I started off teaching the contact lens course, then inherited the external eye disease course, and have always helped on the pharmacology course as well. So that sort of marriage of trying to understand the mixture between contact lenses, pharmacology, and external eye disease is really what married that concept around, hey, I wonder if we can take a contact lens and actually deliver a drug to the eye. So about 2001, I had a graduate student who was looking for a project to do, and silicone hydrogels, of course, had just come out, and so I was interested in whether we could use a silicone hydrogel as a bandage lens, because prior to that, using bandage lenses with hydrogel lenses posed a problem, because if you leave these people in hydrogel lenses overnight for many, many weeks, as you need with a bandage lens, they get hypoxia. So SiHys were great from solving that hypoxic problem. But very often when you have a diseased eye that you need a bandage lens, you very often need to concurrently deliver an ocular pharmaceutical as well, typically antibiotics or steroids. So I was interested in, you know, can we marry a silicone hydrogel with the delivery of a drug? And that's really where that started. It just so happened that around about that time, in probably two or three other institutions around the world, there were groups of researchers trying to do more basic research about drug delivery systemically, not just for the ocular surface. And so it just there's probably about three or four groups around the world now that have kind of latched onto that. Hey, you know, this does not seem like a bad idea. The commercially available lenses are not ideal, because what they tend to do is they'll tend to dump the drug on the eye really very quickly, as opposed to what you really want with the delivery system, which is a slow, sustained release over a period of time. And for that, we now have biomaterial opportunities to be able to control the rate of that delivery. And that's what we've been involved in, and certainly for the last 10 years or so, in a pretty heavy way.
How does one of these things work? I mean, that it's going to give you a nice, steady delivery of the drug over a long period of time.
So there's a number of different ways that you can control that delivery. As I say, typically, if you were to look at the way that we started looking at this, which is just to take a commercial lens, drop it into a drug, let the drug be passively soaked up, and then pop it in your eye, what actually ends up is you have this burst release. So you have this massive release that then slows down. If you're only using a daily disposable lens, actually that works pretty well. You know, so you really don't need to modify it. However, once you get really beyond about 2 to 3 days, then you need something that'll slow that delivery. So there's a couple of different ways you can do it. One, you can actually load the lens up into the drug, and then put an outer coating on the lens that actually prevents that delivery. So you effectively coat the lens once the drug's in it. That's one way. Another way is to actually develop a depot within the lens. So you can develop a contact lens and basically have almost like a thin film within it, which slows the release of that drug, and it sort of passively goes through the lens. That's the second way of doing it. A third ways you can control it using charges. So we have some contact lens materials that are negatively charged. These are ionic lens materials, so typically FDA group 4 lenses. And if you put a positively charged drug into that negatively charged substrate, then the negative lens material holds onto the positive drug, and that also slows the release of that drug. And then another way of doing it is really to encapsulate within the lens the drug into small vesicles. And those small vesicles individually have typically a coating around the vesicle that, again, slows the release of drug from in a very small way. And then the final way of doing it, so there's kind of five different ways in total. The final way is kind of probably the smartest way of doing it, and that's actually one of the things that we've been most interested in. And that's where you would actually create a template within the lens material. So you take a drug of a particular shape and you create cavities within that lens that are molecularly the same shape as that drug. And once you put the drug into that shape, it wants to hold on to that drug because it's a perfect match. It's almost like a hand and glove fit. And so it doesn't want to let that drug go, and so that also slows the delivery to the ocular surface. So yeah, there's four or five different really smart ways of being able to do that now. So, you know, we can probably control the release of a drug really for up to 4 weeks in a particularly controlled way. So that's perfect when you're looking at, you know, increased convenience for patients, because putting a drop in 3, 4, 5 times a day is a real pain in the butt. People don't want to do it. They don't do it, and so you have, you know, poor compliance. And also, not only is compliance better, but you also get very often reduced toxicity values. Because if you're putting a drug into your eye, only about 5% of that drug, if you're putting a drop into your eye, only about 5% of the active drug actually is there and be able to be used. The majority of it either just overruns onto your cheek or drains away through into your down the nasal cavity into your throat. So because you get such a small amount of drug, you often have to overdose the drug. You might have to have the concentration of the drug be 10 times, 20 times what it needs to be. If you're going to slow the release and you know it's going to be there for a long period of time, you can use a lower concentration, reducing the chance of you getting toxicity reactions. So that's a big plus too.
Wow, that's really neat.
Yeah, it's cool.
What do you see coming the next 10 years of contact lens innovation?
Contact lens innovation. So I think you can kind of divide those, I guess, up into a series of different things. You can look at kind of short-term developments, medium-term, and longer-term. In terms of the short-term developments, you know, we've got some really fascinating things coming out very recently that the companies have already disclosed. You've got things now like a photochromic contact lens coming out. That's a very cool concept for people who, you know, basically live in very sunny environments or environments where there's a lot of glare. So we've got those that are going to be coming out very soon. We've already had companies disclose that they're going to be releasing anti-allergy drug delivering contact lenses. So, you know, that concept around drug delivery, which was actually, in fact, interestingly, first described by Victorley in his 1961 patent talking about soft lenses. He actually said that, hey, if we could develop these soft lenses, they'd be a great vehicle for drug delivery. That was 1961, and still we don't have a commercial product at the moment, but that is going to change. So over the next year, we've got those kind of innovations that really aren't going to be true innovations into the market. Then we can look at changes in materials. So, you know, there's no doubt that SiHys have quite definitely solved the hypoxia problem. We just simply don't see that anymore. As an educator, if I want students to see patients with hypoxia, you're pretty much now relegated to being able to have to show them from slides. We just don't see patients with hypoxia these days, or very rarely anyway. So SiHys have solved that, but the one thing that it hasn't solved, that it still hasn't solved, the comfort problem. You know, we've still got 50% of patients complaining towards the end of the day that they would like better comfort. So we do need some comfort changes, and we may see that in, for example, the format of some form of drug delivery through comfort agents might be an option. We could see a change in lens materials that, again, maybe have different surfaces compared to their bulk material. We've already seen that to some extent with the Dailies Total One lens, where we've got a different surface to what we see within the core. But I think we're going to see an extension of other materials around about with that sort of concept, where we have the bulk being mainly delivering oxygen, but the interface, the surface, being modified in some way to be able to enhance wettability and enhance end-of-day comfort. I think that will almost inevitably happen. The format that takes, I think, will be different depending upon the approach of the company, but that will certainly happen. In addition to that, then we see in the more intermediate term, I think we're going to see new developments around about the development of other drugs. So delivering anti-allergy drugs to your eye is great in the short term because you can use a daily disposable lens to do that. You don't need a long-term lens. So I think we will see drug delivering lenses that maybe produce or release other agents over a longer period of time. That will produce some regulatory hurdles, but it certainly will happen. Then we're looking at biosensing lenses, you know, lens materials that are able to basically detect what's in your tear film. And there's a large number of companies and research groups now looking at trying to sense biomarkers within the tear film. I certainly think within the next 5 years, we'll have some product on the market that will be able to do that. We've seen already companies trying to look at being able to detect things like glucose in your tear film. And that's been a challenge because it doesn't exactly follow the glucose levels in your blood. But again, we're seeing companies trying to look at other biomarkers for dry eye, biomarkers for cancer, biomarkers which enable you to be able to detect other systemic changes within your body, things like ovulation. There's a large number of things. The tear film's a very complex pool of things on the surface of your eye. It certainly isn't a simple.
It's not just saline.
It's sure the heck ain't. That's right. It is very complex. So being able to biosense some of those things will be good. And then I think in the longer term, again, we're looking at many companies trying to look at incorporating electronics into contact lens. We already have one on the market now, so there's already a commercially available product that can measure the pressure within inside your eye. So it measures the intraocular pressure by using a little strain gauge. It's available from a Swiss company. That's now been available in Europe for probably about 5 years and in the US for 2 years. So the fact that we can incorporate electronics into contact lenses opens up all kinds of other opportunities to be able to have really quite amazing products that could change prescription, for example. So it would be able to electrochemically be able to change the prescription of a contact lens. So for example, things like accommodating, rather than accommodating IOL, you'd have an accommodating contact lens, which would enable you to see up close. And also things like being able to view emails. So in the same way that we've now got spectacles that can actually view emails, the long-term dream is to be able to have these, you know, look at websites and things and facial recognition. There's all kinds of long-term aims, which will be complicated, but there's enough companies working on them, I think, that we could see some of these in the long term for sure.
I'm still trying to wrap my head around, do I really want to be able to see the World Wide Web 24/7?
Indeed. I think there are lots of opportunities, certainly within, if you like, it's the armed forces that are really very interested in those kind of things. So, you know, they're applying significant amounts of money into that kind of technology, and certainly facial recognition for sure. You know, you imagine if you were looking in particular for some kind of, I think the Mission Impossible last movie had this incorporated into it, and it's, you think, that's science fiction, that's never going to happen. But you know, now with some of the things that companies are working on, some of these patents that are out there are pretty impressive.
Something completely different. What's it like being married to a fellow OD?
You did say this was going live, didn't you? It's good, actually. I mean, so we've worked together. We met in my final year of university, and we've worked in practices together since the mid-80s. We work very differently. So Debbie is very calm, cool, and collected, and I'm not. And so we work very differently when we're seeing patients. We don't tend to talk work very much, so that's a good thing. Debbie's recently been actually our head of department for about 18 months or so. So that kind of sucked because I had to report to her at work and at home. so that was a bit of a challenge. But it's actually good. I mean, the great thing is obviously you know the terminology. So you don't tend to talk work, but when you do, you certainly do understand each other. It's been good that we've been able to, talk about the research side of stuff that we do, the clinical side of stuff, and even down to crazy little things like, hey, I saw this patient today, I thought it was this, what do you reckon? Those kind of things certainly quite help. It's funny though that our kids, so we've got two kids, a 22-year-old daughter and a 19-year-old son, and they'll often say to Debbie, oh, when they hear her lecturing. So she does quite a lot of podcasts and web-based stuff as well. It's like, Mom, you've got your work voice on.
So what's something that your colleagues don't know about you?
What don't my colleagues know about me? So I'm a very competitive sportsman. I always have been. My dad was a semi-professional soccer player. He did his national service back in the 50s when you had to enlist in the UK. And he had a great time because he spent the entire time basically traveling through Egypt and the Middle East playing on a soccer team. That was basically all he did. When he then came out after national service and came back into South Wales, he played as a semi-professional soccer player and had a really good career for a couple of years and actually injured his neck. He was a goalie. So that forced him to give it up. But as a kid, we were basically always had to play sport. So I've grown up never not playing sport. I grew up playing a lot of rugby as a kid in South Wales. Right throughout university, I played rugby. I then injured my neck when I was 25, and that was the end of my rugby career. Came to Canada. Lots and lots of opportunities to play indoor soccer, both co-ed, so men and women on the same team, and men's as well. I picked up soccer really when I came to the UK, when I came to Canada in my mid-30s. And again, just love that competitive sport element. So I'm pretty competitive about most things, but in particular about sport. I think a lot of people know about the fact that I sing. So we had a band at Waterloo that played at many of the major conferences. So for about 15 years, we were often the entertainment at things like the American Academy. So we would alternate with another band at the Australia party. We've sung at the BCLA, we've sung at the Dutch contact lens meeting, we've sung all over the US at various meetings. So we finished that about 5 years ago when two of the guys actually moved away from Waterloo. But I would say singing and competitive sport are the two things that I enjoy most that I think people find a little bit weird, particularly the singing thing. What was really weird is, you know, often I'd be speaking at something like BCLA or the American Academy during the day, and then at the gala dinner, we'd rock up with the band. It was like, he was the guy that I saw lecturing today. What? How's that? So I think that was great. The sheer shock. That was awesome.
So was it your early days as a DJ that got you into singing with bands?
No, not at all. Actually, right throughout school. So as a kid, from probably the age of 6 or 7, I've always sung. My grandfather had a great voice. Coming from South Wales, everybody sings in South Wales. So I sang in a church choir, I sang in a male voice choir. Right throughout school, I was involved in singing and would often at end of year concerts end up doing a couple of solos. So I've always enjoyed singing. And in fact, the only reason I got involved in singing in the band was that one of the other faculty members at Waterloo, John Flanagan, who was instrumental in putting this band together, had actually heard me sing at a couple of weddings that we were at. Now, I have a pretty loud voice. So we'd been at these weddings, and it was like, oh, who's that with the loud voice over there? That's Jonesy. So that's how I ended up singing for the band.
Now, do you play an instrument too, or just sing?
I don't. No, I don't. In fact, I can't even read music, actually. I really listen to music by ear, so I'm never formally trained in music at all. I would love to be able to play guitar. I think it's just so cool. I've tried to encourage both of my kids to play music. My daughter actually is a very good pianist, so she played piano at grade 8. Our son, we tried to get into piano. Not a chance. There's not a hope in heck. Even though I told him it was a great way of being able to meet women, wasn't into it at all.
So who's your favorite vocalist?
I have a very Catholic taste in music, but my real love is probably classic rock. So I still go to many concerts. I love live music, and probably the guys that I enjoy the most are Bryan Adams. He's got such a fantastic voice. I certainly have a much greater appreciation of him now I live here. But probably my most favorite lead singer would be Phil Collins. So I've just saw Phil Collins on his tour again for the first time in many years. Sadly, he has got a bad back, so he's now actually been having to sing sitting down. But just his time with Genesis, I absolutely loved. So that's two of my favorites.
We now move to the Clark Chang commemorative question.
Right.
What do you like to binge watch?
Oh, You know, I really don't watch very much TV. I honestly don't. There's so much blooming work to do. And because we're so involved with, so my kid, my son's a ice hockey player. So we spent a lot of time watching him playing ice hockey. So probably pretty much the only things I ever watch on TV, to be absolutely honest, sport. So I love soccer. So I'll watch soccer every Saturday and Sunday. In the evenings, if there's a hockey game on, I'll watch hockey and news. I really do like to keep in touch with what's going on around the world. So I'll watch news and sport. And that's pretty much it. But I don't really watch anything else.
How should optometry move forward?
Oh, good question. So it's interesting, actually, having moved from the UK, which when I moved had almost no therapeutics at all. So, you know, so the UK had diagnostics way ahead of the US. We had diagnostics back in the 60s and 70s. And the US used our model to be able to get diagnostics. And then it kind of really stopped in the UK. And therapeutics ended up being driven by North America. So when I started coming to the US to conferences, in particular things like the American Academy, I was always very impressed with how far ahead of the game the US was in terms of therapeutics. And actually myself and a couple of colleagues in the UK organized a very, very well attended lecture tour in the UK by Lou Catania. So we got Lou to come over in the mid 90s to actually really put pressure on the regulatory authorities in the UK about saying, hey, you can't practice optometry without being able to treat disease. We had about 10% of the profession that attended this roadshow that we organized around the UK, and that kind of really pushed the development of therapeutic practice in the UK. Now, having come to North America, what we see, of course, is this continued expansion into not only just treating external disease, but in treating disease internally. We've got now, you know, fabulous ways of being able to detect disease. And so there's increasing pressure on optometry schools because there's only a certain number of weeks in the year and days in the week that you can teach students to, okay, we need to get more and more disease, more and more diagnosis, more and more treatment into the curricula. The problem is that when you look at the percentage of patients that you have who present to you in private practice, who actually have disease, it's a relatively small proportion of what you end up seeing on a day-to-day basis. And so my concern as we devote more and more time to the diagnosis and management of disease is that we move away from the kind of bread and butter of what optometry does, which is refraction, pediatrics, contact lenses, binocular vision. Those things at the moment, no one else owns. And my concern is if we reduce our interest and importance on those things that are still very important to the majority of our patients, what we'll see is someone else coming along and saying, hey, you know what, guys, if you don't want that, we'll take it. So I think we need to be cautious of, and I'm very, very supportive of expanding the scope of optometry. My worry is about changing the scope of optometry and moving away from the things that many of our patients need our expertise in to things that there's no question that, you know, patients benefit, but it's a relatively small proportion of those patients in terms of disease. So I think we need to be careful to expand the scope, but not forget also what many of our patients need as well.
Would that include things like developing more formalized optometric specialities?
I'm very much in favor of that. So again, one of the challenges that we have in Canada at the moment is that we have no higher qualifications. You leave optometry, and at the moment across Canada, there are no specialities. You cannot dedicate yourself or nominate yourself as, for example, someone who has a specialist interest in contact lenses or binocular vision or myopia control, for example. In the UK, we've had that for a long period of time. So when I was in the UK, I took higher qualifications in pediatrics, binocular vision and contact lenses. And those qualifications meant a lot to me. It meant that I could, you know, genuinely hold my head up and say, hey, you know what? I may not be an expert in these, but I can genuinely say I have an advanced level of knowledge in these areas. Of course, that's been the same in the US. So through the diplomates that you can take through the academy, plus also the fellowships that you can take, you can actually, again, point to, hey, I have an ex, I have an interest and a confirmed increased knowledge in these areas, and we're very supportive at the School of Optometry in Waterloo in terms of being able to now develop that within Canada. I think it's important that practitioners, when they leave optometry school, continue to believe in lifelong learning. In order to do that, a great way of doing that is by being able to show that you have a particular interest and speciality that you've developed in certain areas. So I think developing particular strengths that you can point to through training and then a formal way of examination is important. So I'm a great believer in that.
Do you have any regrets?
Any regrets? I regret not being able to play sport at an international level. I would have loved to been able to. I'm still very Welsh, so I was born in Wales. If someone asks me where home is still Wales, even though I left Wales when I was 20. So 35 years ago I left Wales, but it'll always be my home. And I think it doesn't matter where you're from. Often where you're born is still where home is. I then lived in the UK for about 15 years. And I've now been in Canada for 20 years. So I would have loved to have been a professional athlete. I'm very fortunate. My son actually has just signed an NHL contract. So he's a junior hockey player at the moment. He got drafted to the Las Vegas Golden Knights 18 months ago. So when they first formed, and the Knights signed him back this past summer. So, he's going along that route. I live vicariously through my son's hockey. He played for Team Canada a couple of years ago as well. So I love that. But do I have any other regrets professionally? I don't think so. I think I've actually been extraordinarily lucky. I think I've had great mentors in my life, people who invested a lot of time and effort in me throughout my time at university. Then throughout my time in my early career, at my time both in the UK and also since I've been to Waterloo. So, I've had great people to be able to follow. And I think having regrets is really doesn't help you very much. You made those decisions, suck it up, princess, get on with it. And I think the choices that I made, I was very, very fortunate. I never imagined that I would do a PhD. Certainly not a chance. When I went to university, it was purely to get me out of South Wales and get me into some kind of profession. Never imagined I'd be doing the job that I'm doing now. And my guess is anyone who knew me in school would never imagine that I'm doing what I'm doing now. So I think I've been very fortunate to make the decisions that I have along the way. And most of those were driven by the people who were my mentors.
Now for the last question, and we inflict this one on everybody. What's the craziest thing you've ever done?
My goodness me. Why wouldn't I have thought about this beforehand? What's the craziest thing I've ever done? I'm not really a risk taker. In all fairness, I'm really not a great risk taker. My daughter took, in her gap year, actually went to work at the School of Optometry at UNSW in Sydney. And then ended up going to New Zealand and did like the most crazy thing. She went skydiving. She was like, you're doing what, Bex? There's not a chance I would ever do anything like that. So I don't think I've ever really done anything completely crazy, because I think I'm a kind of pretty boring, risk averse person, to be quite honest with you, which is, what a terrible answer to that question.
Crazy is also something that can be out of character.
I guess I remember my father telling me what he thought. I thought that the most crazy thing I'd ever done, and that was to give up our partnership in the UK. So the practices that Debbie and I had in the UK, they were very successful. We saw a lot of patients. We saw about 35,000 patients a year. We had about 15,000 contact lens patients. We had 28 staff. They'd won all these awards. And we got bored. We just wanted a new challenge. And I remember saying to my dad, "Dad, we decided that we're going to sell out of the practice and go and work at a university. And the way that universities work is that you only ever go there for a period of time where you're basically on probation." So you kind of looked at me and went, "Hang on a second. So you're giving up this practice that you own, where you make a very nice salary, Very nice living. You're your own boss and you're giving it all up to go on be probation in a university environment at much less money in another country. Is that right? Yeah, that's about right, Dad. And I remember him telling me then, you are out of your mind. What are you thinking? And it did make us think, yeah, what are we thinking? So I guess that probably is the most bizarre decision we ever made. But in hindsight, it was the best decision we ever made. I love teaching. Debbie loves teaching. Our opportunities at the university to teach the students and the graduate students is really a great privilege. I think being able to educate the people of tomorrow who are going to use the skills that you give them and to be important to their patients is really a great privilege. It was a good move.
I just realized I forgot to ask you this question. What keeps you engaged in teaching and research versus private practice or industry?
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing that I really do of all the jobs that I do at the university, and you know, we have to end up kind of doing three things if you're at a university. You've got to teach, you've got to do scholarship, research, publishing, and you've got to do administration. The thing I enjoy the most is teaching. I absolutely love teaching, and it doesn't matter whether I'm teaching undergraduate students, graduate students, postdocs, or the profession. When I do go out and do continuing education lectures, that's the thing that really gives me the greatest pleasure. So that would be number one. Number two would be research. I love doing research. I love being involved in research. It's great to be able to discover things, and you know, someone gives you a report or gives you some data, and you look and go, "Wow, that's awesome!" And that's, you know, it's been like that forever and a day. And we're very fortunate. We have, you know, 50 people in our group that does pretty much research. And then the thing I enjoy the least, as anyone does, is administration. In terms of what I actually do, the most of what I do is administration. The next is research, and the thing I do least is teaching. So that's the way it is. Very often, that's the way in a university. You know, it's the longer you're around and the higher up the tree, the more of one administration you end up having to do. But fortunately, being director of CORE is great. We have such great people, such great dedicated people to what it is that we do. It's wonderful to be that leader. So great job I have.
Okay, Lyndon, that's all the questions I have for you. Thank you for taking the time to chat with me, and I'm glad we got this one in the can.
Yeah, my apologies again. I can't believe that. I think this is like the fourth time.
It is. It is like the fourth time, but, you know, yeah. It happens. Believe me, I'm always playing tag with somebody, so it's no problem.
Okay, great. Thanks a lot, Vernon.
Bye-bye. Cheers.